Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Joining us today, we have a journalist and an author. He's written a new book called Down Along with That Devil's Bones. It's a reckoning with monuments, memory, and the legacy of white supremacy. So welcome to the show, Connor Town O'Neill.
Hey, thanks. Good to be with you.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
it's a long title, I know. I've always liked long titles.
You've done this well. Before we get into the subject, so how did you get to where you wanted to write a book about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's not so much that I chose this topic as kind of fell down a rabbit hole about this topic. I was in Selma, Alabama for the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. That's the attack by Alabama police officers on civil rights demonstrators at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, sort of the climax of the civil rights movement in 1965, that, you know, provided the tailwind to pass the Voting Rights Act that year. And 50 years later, I was there to report on the anniversary. President Obama was there to speak and to cross over the bridge in sort of symbolic remembrance of that history. And 40,000 other people showed up to see the speech and to be there for the day. And Selma is a small city. I mean, you know, it's the kind of place that gets sort of overrun if 40,000 people show up. So parking was a nightmare. And like a lot of small southern cities, Selma has this big cemetery. And it's pretty close to downtown within walking distance. So I figure, okay, I'll find a place to stash my car over there. I'll walk down to the bridge. I'll be there, think about the civil rights movement, and head home. And ended up finding way more than I bargained for. So there's a section of the cemetery there that's called Confederate Memorial Circle. When I pull in, I see all of these signs staked into the grass. Confederate Memorial Circle closed, no trespassing. A bunch of people scowling at me as I pull in. And that's kind of catnip, you know, that's catnip for a reporter. So I wander over and, you know, kind of credulously ask them what they're doing, and come to learn that this group who calls themselves the Friends of Forest had spent really the better part of the last two decades fighting about this statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest they had put up. Forrest is seen by Confederates, people that admire him as, you know, a canny military leader. But of course, he was also a slave trader before the war. He was an accused war criminal during the war, served as the first Grand Wizard of the Klan after the war. So he's an incredibly controversial figure. And so to put up a statue of him in Selma was all the more controversial given Selma's history and connection to the civil rights movement. Compounding that then, they had put the statue up the same week that the city had elected its first black mayor back in 2000. So it's just an enormously controversial thing to do. That statue was eventually stolen, I learned, and prompted even more fighting and debate, and protests, and eventually a federal lawsuit that the Friends of Forest had recently won. When I met them in 2015, they were fresh off a win in federal court that was going to allow them to replace this statue. So, you know, I the dissonance of this encounter of meeting these neo-Confederates on a day of major civil rights anniversary just really kind of threw me for a loop and raised all of these questions about who Forrest was, what it meant to put up a statue to him in 2015. And so, you know, here I am 5 years later still chasing after those questions. But yeah, that's what sent me on this journey.
That's pretty interesting. You know, the myself being a Canadian and being down in the States, I was pretty unaware of a lot of the Confederacy. You know, like who they are and what they've done. But one thing I do notice is there's a lot of American television and movies, especially from the 60s and 70s. You know, John Wayne and all those, and they almost celebrate Confederacy. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Well,
I think
I was just going to say, why is that? Why is that? The Confederates lost, and they sort of were not fighting for really a good reason, right? As far as I understand. So, why are they so, well, especially back in that generation, why were they so idolized?
Yeah, that's a great question. The Confederates were making it clear, really to anyone who would listen, in the lead-up to the war, why they were fighting. You can look at the Articles of Secession that the different states ratify. You can look at the speeches of the Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, or the vice president, Alexander H. Stephens. And they're saying explicitly, we are doing this to protect the system of slavery and to expand it into the West. And we're doing it based on this foundational or cornerstone belief, as they put it, that the people that they were enslaving were inherently inferior, stamped by God with that inferiority. And so it really is this explicitly, you know, white supremacist project. They are fighting to create an ethnostate in, you know, former American states in the South. That creates a lot of problems after the war about how you remember it. 750,000 people died, and in the South, there were thorny questions about how you were going to think about that loss and how you were going to commemorate that loss. And as the great historian David Blight points out, there were really two things that Americans had to do after the war. The first was to vest full, you know, political empowerment to the formerly enslaved, you know, equal protection under the law, voting rights, you know, the things enshrined in the 14th and 15th Amendments. The other task was for the sort of sectional reunion of white Americans, North and South, the kind of brother versus brother fighting, to reconcile that. And they were always going to be mutually exclusive. And of course, this sectional reunion, won out over a full investment of citizenship in black Americans. And so you have a way moving forward after Reconstruction, you have a way of remembering the war that's just about the sacrifice of the Southern soldier, the tragedy of his death, real magical thinking about what the system of slavery was, you know, telling lies about how it was all benevolent masters and contented enslaved people, you know, these fictions that we told ourselves to cope, one, with the massive losses of the war, but two, because even if slavery ended, the lie of black inferiority that was being told to justify it was perpetuated and you know, continued to dominate so much of American life long after the war. But it allowed people in the North and the South to look at the Confederacy as, you know, rebels, as, you know, just sort of hard scrabble, you know, don't mean nobody harm, Dukes of Hazzard type stuff, that totally ignores the reason that they were fighting and the consequence of fighting to keep this system of slavery that was, you know, physical and spiritual torture, predicated on this lie that the people that they were enslaving sort of deserved it. That's tough to square up to and be honest about and talk about a lot. It's far easier to, you know, tell a story about the Dukes of Hazzard. So I think that's why, and that's, you know, intoxicating and seductive way of looking at the past. And so that's why we get these depictions in media of someone like John Wayne, you know, brave, tough, rash, but, you know, totally overlooking the deeper consequences of what the Confederacy represented.
Yeah, I living out in West Virginia right now. My home is D.C., and it's so interesting to me to see, and I guess you're from Pennsylvania, so you may see some of this too, where you have people in West Virginia flying the Confederate flag, and Pennsylvania flying the Confederate flag. And I'm just kind of I'm scratching my head at that, because historically, you know, that's not the case, you know. And like, so what do you think, what do you think it means now? Like, what does it mean to contemporary, you know, these people who are putting up the Nathan Bedford Forrest statue? What does that actually, that symbol mean to them? Is it about the past or something else?
I think it says something about the past, but it says something about the present too. You know, it's not a coincidence that a statue of Forrest goes up just after a majority black city that is synonymous with black voting rights, the first black mayor. So it's about, you know, obviously monuments are seeking to honor a figure from the past, but these statues don't just show up out of nowhere. They require money, they require political capital, they require connections, they require land. You know, so there's a way of looking at the statue as a reflection of values in the present just as much as it is about, you know, seeking to honor someone from the past. And, you know, I think the Confederate flag might mean, or, you know, Confederate symbols generally always have such specific meanings. You know, I look at four different monuments of Forrest, and they mean slightly different things in each city that they're, each city that they go up in, just like it means something different to fly the Confederate flag in Alabama than it would in Michigan. But I think the core, it is still about race. It is still about, you know, seeking to make a statement about power and about racial power.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly it strikes me as that's playing a big part of it, but also that sort of image of like what people, you know, you're talking about the sort of the bravado of whiteness, or the sort of that hard scrabble, like there's something embedded in there too. I mean, this is, you know, just
the romance of the rebel.
The romance of the rebel. Right. Perfect. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But I think for sure. I think that's in the brew as well. But it's worth asking, you know, who, if you're flying the flag to be a rebel in, you know, as you're occupying the state house in Michigan, who are you rebelling against? And, or if you're just trying to, you know, rile people up or, you know, make people angry, who are you trying to make angry and why? And I think that once you ask those questions, it's romantic to be a rebel, but it always does come back to, this idea of prerogative and resentment, you know, that's a sort of long-standing white resentment in a country that's true everywhere, and not just the South. The rebel flag is a useful symbol for that.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what is it you hope people get from this book?
I hope that We can, I mean, you sort of flatter yourself if you answer a question like that. But I mean, you know, ideally, you know, I hope that this can be some small step to getting us to a common understanding of our past. That I think often we have a naive sense about how we should use our history and what we should, why we should look to the past. And I think often the impulse is to look to the past to sort of flatter ourselves and to tell us a story about American exceptionalism and why we're the greatest country in the world. And instead, I think we could also look to the past and should also look to the past as a way of understanding how we've wound up in the moment that we're in and with the sorts of drastic inequalities that we still have in this country. So if we can look to the past and if we can look to the Civil War specifically as a way of understanding.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Standing say why we have a 10-to-1 racial wealth gap in this country, or why the pandemic is the disparate deaths along racial lines because of the pandemic are pointing up unequal access to good health care, or why, you know, the state-sanctioned murder of George Floyd in the streets of Minneapolis is such a horrifyingly common occurrence. If we can look to the past in the Civil War, not to flatter us or not to find romance in the rebel, but instead to understand why we have the present that we have, you know, then I think we'd be that much closer to building a consensus for, you know, the policies that might address those inequities. So, you know, that's big, I know. And I don't flatter myself that, you know, reading this book has the answers. But I think if we really can start to use history in a different way, in a way that holds us responsible and helps us understand the country that we've inherited, we might be closer to really grappling with the present.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Soon I am moving to Richmond, Virginia in a few weeks, actually, leaving D.C. And so I personally am very fascinated by the transformation that's gone in that city and with its monuments.
Yeah.
And some really interesting, a lot of exuberance and joy, which around, you know, taking down those monuments, which, and of course, a lot of people, you know, very, you know, against it. But I mean, what do you see? Like, I mean, how do we translate these spaces into something fresh? How do we engage with history? Like, what is the, you know, in terms of just the monuments, you know, taking down, sure, but what's the next step, do you think?
Yeah, I think that a lot of the images this summer from Richmond have been really powerful. The graffiti
yeah.
on the Lee
oh, yeah.
monument projecting the face of George Floyd onto it, reclaiming or recontextualizing what those monuments mean, I think has been really powerful. I think, you know, the next step is, one, I should say, I'm a little hesitant to say what, you know, I'm willing to defer to people in the cities in which these monuments stand about,
sure.
you know, what should be done with them or what's next, because I think there are different issues in different cities. But generally, you know, I think ideally there's a, you know, a logical progression in the thinking that goes, you know, that statue is wrong. It's wrong that that statue is here. Okay, why is it wrong that statue is here? What is that a symbol of in the present that makes it wrong? And whatever your answer is to that question, whether it's, you know, how we fund public schools or how you buy a house in the city that you live in, and who gets, you know, good mortgages to buy the house in the quote unquote right neighborhoods to go to the quote unquote right schools. You know, whatever it is that makes it galling that there's a statue of Robert E. Lee in downtown Richmond in 2020, whatever that pings off of in the present, I think can, you know, should orient you to what you want to do next. And I guess I'm a little hesitant to get too specific about it because that might lead you anywhere. I mean, this,
right.
the ways that this lie about race has been used to hoard wealth, to hoard resources, to hoard opportunities, to hoard land. I mean, just infiltrates every aspect of our society. So, you know, I think if you look, you know, how a concept like whiteness is used and how the outcomes of so many policies in so many areas of life turn to benefit white Americans, you know, you might then do the next thing might be anywhere. It might be healthcare. It might be housing. It might be schooling. It's everywhere. So, but I think understanding that one, you know, this lie about race, that psychotic idea of race in America, is not inevitable. But instead is a way of, perpetuating this racial hierarchy that we have. And so, you know, undo that wherever you are, whether it's, you know, the way, you know, power works in your workplace, or in your neighborhood or wherever. But I think just being sensitized to issues that race is a tool for power, that might lead you to whatever comes next.
Great.
Well, you know, I have to wonder in these times right now with, the things going on, there's a lot of history revision. There's a lot of people that don't believe in, you know, they'll say it's liberal history, it's not true. How do you counter something like that?
The historical record, often. You know, like I said, like there were, you know, people worry that, like, oh, we take down the history, we erase, or we take down the statue, we erase history. You know, but the history is there in the archives, and the history is not flattering. So, you know, I think that's the first step, and that's pretty straightforward. But it does get thornier than that. I don't mean to suggest that it's that simple. We see in things like the debates from the New York Times, the 1619 Project, that there are, the fight is not so much about what the history is, but how to interpret it or what the consequence of that history is. People want to dispute, you know, just how important, just how influential the arrival of enslaved Africans was in, you know, the British North America. There's not a debate about whether that happened in 1619, but there is a debate. You know, some people on the right really do want to cling tightly to these ideas of a version of not history, but the consequences of the history, like looking to 1776 with reverence. It's really a question of the consequence of our history. And so then I think the next step after you look at the, you know, what the actual historical record says is to then look at the present and say, like, okay, if we can even get past trying to look into the hearts of people and weigh whether this individual was a racist or not, and instead look at the outcomes of the policies and the systems that they are involved in, who benefits, who's punished, you know, who's made vulnerable, then I think you have an almost moral duty to change. Now, whether or not people take up that moral duty is certainly another question. But, you know, and how much you want to make a sort of moral argument, you know, how effective that is, I think we could debate for a long time. But I think if you do look at outcomes and you do look at the consequences of the history in the present, it really does go to show that there's a lasting injury from the system of slavery and the lies that we were telling ourselves to justify that system. So yeah, I mean, we've managed to ignore it for a long time, going back to, you know, you pointing out how we remember the Confederacy in the 60s and the 70s with John Wayne and you know, Beau Duke. But there is a moral urgency to change how we look at that.
I was just going to say, I was going to ask sort of what was probably the most challenging part of writing this book. I mean, what did you find was the hardest part of this for you personally?
I mean, from a craft point of view, from the actual writing of it, the hardest part was to find a way of balancing past and present. And finding things that had really good narrative hooks, had strong beginnings, middles, and ends, had, you know, good characters in them. And finding ways of talking about what can be, you know, sort of heady or complicated ideas of the, you know, the social construction of race, you know, these sort of more theoretical, more academic ideas, finding ways of talking about them, in a way that is accessible, and doesn't disrupt the narrative, the stories that I'm telling in the book. So that was a real balancing act from the writing of it. In the reporting of it, I think a lot of it was just getting, it was hard to get people to talk. You know, generally it's hard to report, over the last couple of years in the era of fake news. people are skeptical of journalists, and especially in a topic that is such a controversial one as Nathan Bedford Forrest. But it's difficult for people on both sides. You know, I think that the folks who love Forrest, some of them were skeptical of me because they feel like it's, quote, their story. They have their version of history. They have their reasons for loving him. And they think that they don't get a fair shake. There's this revisionist history over the, you know, in recent years that is, you know, telling them what to do and how to think about their heroes. So they don't want, you know, one more journalist with a Pennsylvania number calling them up, just trying to get them to talk, to tell their story if they can't control how it's told. And then I think people, you know, activists, people who have been, you know, insulted or on the affected by these monuments, Black Americans who have, involved in these stories, I think we're skeptical of me for the inverse of that, feeling like this is some interloping white journalist who just wants to sort of get the story because there's a spectacle to it, you know. Statue of the first Grand Wizard of the Klan goes up the same week that you elect your first Black mayor, like, oh, that's a juicy story. And so I think, you know, folks who were involved in that story were skeptical of me, and questioning why I wanted to tell that story and how I was going to tell that story. So that posed some challenges in the reporting. But as is true in any story, you just keep showing up, keep calling, keep trying to get people to talk, keep trying to show that you're doing this in good faith and will be, you know, respectful to their point of view. So, yeah, but that was certainly challenging.
I bet, sure.
So what's up for you next?
It's a $1 million question. I think I want to dig. I talk about this a little bit in the book, but I think I want to dive into it with both feet now. My family has a deep history in New England, descendants from the Mayflower, and involved in the Salem witch trials. And I think I want to dig even deeper into those historical stories and trying to understand how that earlier, you know, Puritan and colonial history is still shaping our present. So I, you know, a similar approach, trying to balance history and history and present day reporting, but to jump back a few more centuries even and do some reporting in the North now.
Well, fantastic. Well, it's been a really good conversation. It's a very interesting subject, and it's something I think we need to talk about more. Is there a particular place? Do you have a website or something that people can reach you on, or are you hiding?
No, not hiding. Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Town O'Neill, TOWNEONEILL, and my website is ConnorTownO'Neill.space. So yeah, drop me a line.
Okay, fantastic. We'll have you listed on our website as well. Our guest has been Connor Town O'Neill, and we've been talking about his new book, Down Along with the Devil's Bones. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Connor.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thanks, y'all.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.